This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2014. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbett, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast this month, we'll hear readings from Cynthia Cruz.
I saw a craft of orphans streaming down the river.
And from Rodrigo Toscano.
Are you dying now, at this moment? I hope not. Okay.
We'll also talk with Michael Robbins about James Dickey.
He actually was quite fiery and actually very strange and wild in a lot of ways.
There's, of course, quite a bit more in the issue that won't fit into this podcast. Here's just a few of the things you'll be missing if you don't get a hold of an issue. There are poems by Tom Slay, written after the great Spanish-language poet Cesar Vallejo.
Poems in translation by the Slovenian poet Tomas Salamun, and a mixed-media composition by Caroline Bergvall called Drift.
We're joined this month by Poetry Magazine's consulting editor, Christina Pugh. Christina, we asked you to pick a poem from the issue to read and talk about, so what did you choose?
I chose Bob Hickok's The Pregnancy of Words. This poem is just all over exuberance with language, and maybe I'll just read it. I think it needs no introduction. Eros scrabbles to rose, enraged to gear or gare, as in Gare du Nord, where I trained into Paris from not smoking pot and master mad, I'm sorry, Amsterdam, with its canals called Gracht and clocks that bonged my homesick hours at different times. Which is smite for you violet types, a flower that says love it if you listen. Me, I do, and don't feel it matters that evil thrives in live, that we tinker and smash everything down to bits and then try to patch a path back home. It's our lotto in life to have no clue what a natural disaster is when that disaster is us. That's what I love about the shrug. It says zilch sans le mouth and becomes more aerobic the more you admit the less you know, you know? It's a jumble out there, kids, with slips and slides and a lides ilioule, depending what's lopped off, as in light of hand or sleight of and. But I better spot before you pots how sparse this parsing is. Besides, what can I say about language other than it's an anal egg in need of one glorious you? Words are sword. Pick your poisson. Every time I try to peek into speaking the bag of gab to learn what our noodles are really up to, I get flummoxed that the tools I use are the stool I stand on to see a way in or out. I can't even tell if I'm more trapped or wrapped, if meaning's mean or plays a dumb waiter riding numbly up and down. But have you noticed read becomes dear if you ignore the world as you find it and find it in you to swirl the word? In the way solve and loves are the same bones, different skeletons.
I'm filled with admiration at the way you read it so well.
Yeah.
You know, without stumbling, because it's it is a very tricky poem.
Well, it's aerobic, as he says. I mean, before you even get to aerobic, you know, I was the word that was going through my mind was acrobatic, the way that the lines work and the velocity of them. Very aerobic for the reader aloud as well. Some readers may be familiar with his recent book, Elegy Ode, which is a wonderful book, but a very sad one in a lot of ways. And I just got a thrill from reading how much pleasure and delight was in this poem.
It's enjoyable, but I also sense a sort of ambivalence from the speaker about this whole exercise itself.
Yeah.
Like where he says, I better spot before you pots how sparse this parsing is. He's kind of acknowledging, like, what is the worth of finding out how all these words anagram? And is this a worthy endeavor or is it just a playful act?
Or a misprint. You always hear that Oscar Wilde said a poem can survive everything but a misprint. I always wondered about that because poems actually do survive misprints. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to, like, read any Shakespeare. For example.
Exactly.
But reading this poem helps me understand that a little bit, how that works.
And there is that moment, too, where the poem says, it's our lotto in life to have no clue what a natural disaster is when that disaster is us.
Yeah.
And that also seems a similar moment in that there's a kind of entropic, disastrous quality of this on whatever level. And on the other hand, he also wants to go with it.
I think that does get into this poet's other work as well, that sort of awareness of,
yes,
you know, real news, day-to-day stuff. So not just a kind of dexterity and cleverness, but a real connection is
absolutely
supplied to the language and to the world. Well, also in the May issue, we have a section called Angels of the Americlips, New Latino Writing. It's actually a selection of poets from a new anthology of that same name, edited by John Chavez and Carmen Jimenez-Smith.
We asked Carmen Jimenez-Smith what their goal was in putting together this very ambitious anthology.
Our goal was twofold, and that was to expand the canon of contemporary Latino writers who are engaging with identity, but also point to Latino writers who are doing innovative writing.
We're going to hear from two of the poets in the anthology who are also in the May issue. First up, Cynthia Cruz, who is new to Poetry Magazine. I've been after her work for a while, but you've probably seen her poems in other places like the New Yorker, Paris Review, and many other journals.
Cynthia Cruz is the author of two collections of poems, Ruin and The Glimmering Room. We have two of her poems in the May issue. The first is a dreamlike poem called Sparks, Nevada.
In the middle of the night, Father brought me a falcon. By morning, it ripped the wire and flew the hill into the highway. When they found me in that car, my sleeve stemmed in blood. I didn't know what it was I was trying to kill. I saw a craft of orphans streaming down the river. They were dressed in white and silent as a séance. It was then I spoke to the bird. Already God is shaking his black seed back into me.
After I read this poem, I started reading about falconry because I couldn't remember what exactly you're supposed to do when you're working with a falcon. And it's obviously a very dangerous pursuit. And so at the beginning of falconry, you have the falcon on a sort of harness. I don't think that's the right word, but attached to you so that it bonds with you and it won't fly away. And so obviously what's happened here, it's ripped that harness, or as she calls it, the wire that has attached her to the bird, or that's how I interpret it.
By morning, it ripped the wire and flew the hill into the highway. When they found me in that car, my sleeve stemmed in blood. I didn't know what it was I was trying to kill.
And what's really interesting to me here is it seems ambiguous what that's referring to, whether what she wanted the falcon to kill, as in a mouse or some sort of hunting, or if it was something like the wildness she was trying to kill within the bird, or if it was something within herself.
Yeah, I think for me that was one of the interesting elements of this poem is, with a connection to Hickok, there's a lot of elision.
Mm-hmm.
It's not elision within words, but it's elision of narrative, as you suggest. And the notion that I didn't know what it was I was trying to kill could be interpreted in so many ways. Even just the stanza break between it ripped the wire and flew the hill into the highway, next stanza beginning, when they found me in that car, my sleeve stemmed in blood. You know, one gets the sense there's this entire portion of narrative that's been excised or elided from it to make a much more condensed experience for the reader, almost dreamlike.
I saw a craft of orphans streaming down the river. They were dressed in white and silent as a seance. It was then I spoke to the bird.
What's remarkable for me is this vision of orphans dressed in white, and it's then, she says, it was then I spoke to the bird. And then, like all really fine poets, she kind of ups the ante, because I know a great many poets who would have stopped right there. That's a sort of great last line. It was then I spoke to the bird, but she doesn't.
Already God is shaking his black seed back into me.
And that kind of thunderous, it's like Leda and the swan or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely shocking, I think, and unexpected and violent, and yet the sort of cool, calm, controlled language of the poem makes it even more chilling. So you wonder, too, about Father bringing her a falcon, and what she ends up with is basically God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking God is kind of a literal deus ex machina coming in at the end there. The other thing that crosses my mind about this poem, I don't know whether other people have this experience, or it's just me, but I want to say, haven't we all had dreams like this too, of sort of having a, you know, an animal or a dog or a cat or a bird or something that we can't control that starts to attack or that turns on the self or something? It seems very archetypal in some ways.
Well, and then there's the mystery of Sparks, Nevada. Mm, I mean, there's something very interesting about those sparks that are not really sparks, and being in a place like Sparks, Nevada, which is a very particular setting for this. It's not the same place really, but it sort of flitted through my mind as sort of a Breaking Bad kind of scenario where you know, they're always driving out into the desert and, you know, all this weird stuff gets out of control out there, and it's a very cinematic thing. But you're right, it's a kind of thing that only really takes place in dreams and in poetry, but I think genuinely troubling and impressive.
Let's hear the second poem we have from Cynthia Cruz. This one is called 12 in Yellow Weed at the Edge.
Then the police arrive. They don't find me. I'm disguised as a boy in a champagne wig and hid inside the gold rattle of a warm Appalachia wind. Beneath the trash of willow I am. The sorrow of trailer parks and carny uncles. The poor girl's underworld, a weedy thing. The night with its kingdom of lanterns and awful blue lark. How we waited, how we hid, like wolves in the revolving question of a field.
Christina, you talked about elision in the last one, and I think that's here too, especially with the way the poem starts. Then the police arrive. They don't find me. We don't know why they're looking for her or what happened before that then, but it's a very fitting start for this poem where if all you're doing is hiding, there has to be some sort of reason you're there.
Well, not only hiding, but disguised.
Right.
As a boy in a champagne wig, which is not the first disguise that occurs to people who are sort of hiding out from the law. But that, again, is consistent with the really eerie and compelling details this poet provides.
And hid inside the gold rattle of a warm Appalachia wind.
Sounds like Aaron Copland or something.
Beneath the trash of willow I am.
It's very brave because in the poem this character is hiding out but still willing to assert herself by saying I am. The thing that is compelling her to hide or be hidden does not mean that she's trying to be invisible.
Right, but that syntax kind of hides her within it too. It's what she's hiding under comes first in that sentence.
The poor girl's underworld, a weedy thing.
That's Shakespearean too, the weedy trophies. I think that's how Ophelia is described when she drowns down with her weedy trophies in that great scene in Hamlet where Gertrude describes her and everybody's like, if you saw her drown, why didn't you try to save her? You saw it that clearly. But it's a great moment in that word weedy.
And that connection of human drama, again, with animal nature is really striking. You have, of course, the kingdom of lanterns and awful blue lark, but that last two lines.
How we waited, how we hid, like wolves in the revolving question of a field.
Man, if you've ever been anywhere near where wolves are sort of hiding, always on the periphery, that is sort of something that this poem evokes. That waiting and waiting like wolves is very serious vigilance. That's real waiting. And, of course, the revolving question of a field where, you know, there's, again, like the other poem, there's sort of a swirl of uncertainty and being sort of in the wilderness of things.
Next up is Rodrigo Toscano, a poet, playwright, and performer originally from Los Angeles who now lives in Brooklyn.
Rodrigo Toscano's latest book is called Deck of Deeds. The only thing you'd need to know about the poem you're about to hear is its title.
At a bus stop in El Barrio.
And also that banana in Spanish sounds like banana.
The banana going to kill you. Excuse me? The banana going to kill you. I'm sorry, I don't understand. Okay, so banana have sustenance, no? Okay, It's true, if you have sustenance, you probably live another day. I suppose so. Look, all right. If you eat a banana, you will be living up ahead, right? Yeah, all right, so? Okay, are you dying now? What? Are you dying now, at this moment? I hope not. Okay. It's true, up ahead, you die at some point? Of course. All right. So, banana push you there. The banana going to kill you, baby.
I shouldn't laugh. That's a scary poem, too. I just remember, I think we all do here, actually, when that poem came in, the second we saw it, we just couldn't get over this this poem. It's so remarkable. And, of course, Rodrigo is a performer and, you know, his work is very dramatic. As a poem, this is about as dramatic as it gets. It's tense, I think, even to read it, even if you don't read it out loud. I mean, seeing it on the page, you're sort of going back and forth. And the sort of Anglo-sounding lines are very terse and short.
Excuse me? Yeah. All right. So?
What's fascinating to me is the expansiveness of the person with the advice about the banana.
All right. If you eat a banana, you will be living up ahead, right?
That expansiveness is counterpointed by these tiny, you know, non-committal phrases that are meant to push this person away a little bit. And it doesn't work. But there's just the inadequacy of the dominant culture's language is really kind of the heart and soul of this drama. Just like, you know, I hope not. You know, of course. You know, that kind of
Well, it's very, I mean, there's something about it that's very Socratic, too.
Not the same thing.
You know, it's like, it's sort of like what Socrates is always doing is kind of pushing his interlocutor into a corner and saying, like, okay, so you've got to grant me this.
It's true. If you have sustenance, you probably live another day.
That word sustenance is really at the heart of the poem. It's like, if you have sustenance, you live another day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then what happens? It's, you can see the end coming a mile away. Like, if you agree to the, it's like, you know, like they say in vaudeville, if you buy the premise, you buy the bit. And the minute that word comes out, is true if you have sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
And once you hear that word and that line, you are done for. So that by the end of the poem, there's no question about it whatsoever.
La banana going to kill you, baby.
Okay, we're going to say goodbye now to Christina Pugh and hello to Michael Robbins, who's going to talk to us about James Dickey.
Michael Robbins is the author of two collections of poems, Second Sex and Alien vs. Predator. In the May issue, he reviews the complete poems of James Dickey, which came out last year from the University of South Carolina Press. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dawn. Hi, Lindsay.
You know, before we start talking about James Dickey, we need to ask you about these big collected poems and complete poems in general. Isn't it a great thing to have all of a poet's work in one handy volume, including dress revisions and juvenilia?
But I do think it's a good thing to have complete editions and collected editions. But I think it's the publishers that I have a beef with who take advantage of the event or the aura surrounding the collected to produce these huge, expensive editions. And I also do think, I should say, that all of these drafts and these juvenilia and the variations and all of that crap represents a kind of fetishization of the poetic process that I just find wearisome. I want to know if anyone really reads through all those things besides scholars.
And I do.
Well, you're the editor of Poetry Magazine.
Oh, that's true. So the thing about this is I'm old enough to have been interested in James Dickey's poems for a very long time, and I knew him a little bit.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And so for me, the appearance of this book was sort of a big deal. You know, it's like, well, finally, because there were other attempts at complete poems, including slightly more portable editions. But I was kind of looking forward to this enormous book of his poems. And I think it's hard to describe for people who weren't around what kind of enormous reputation, you know, James Dickey did have as a poet, a novelist, a judge, for important poetry contests and things like that,
right,
back in the 60s and 70s and even beyond. Can you maybe give our listeners a sense of the regard people held him in?
He was huge. Of course, it wasn't just that he was a poet, but that he had written Deliverance, which became a movie that people still know. When Dickey was appearing on Johnny Carson and writing about the Apollo missions for Life magazine and reading Jimmy Carter's inaugural poem, so for that reputation to have been somewhat eclipsed the way that his predecessor in celebrity Robert Lowell's has been, I think is both a return to normal, you know, an indication of his overvaluation, and a sort of passing of something that we might not see again in American poetry. And I'm not claiming that it was a good or bad thing for us to have celebrity poets. I don't actually care, but sociologically I think it's an interesting thing.
Can you tell us about when you first read James Dickey and what you thought and what it's like to reread him now?
He bored me, to be honest. You know, when you're 20, you read the poets who spark a fire in you, and the Dickey that I glanced at was not fiery. And it was interesting later to come to Dickey to try to read him more seriously after I had sort of moved away from the poems of the sort of middle American and Northwestern angst, to find that he actually was quite fiery and actually very strange and wild in a lot of ways.
Well, you say that it's in his middle poems that he flashes out into this raw, free sharpness. So
yeah,
you want to read a few lines from something like, you point out May Day sermon to the women of Gilmer County, Georgia, by a woman preacher leaving the Baptist church, which I always loved. I grew up in the South. That's one of my favorite poems by anybody. But maybe you can read a few lines of that.
What a great poem it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the opening stanza. I'll just read it. It's just a perfect beginning. And that title is amazing. May Day Sermon to the Women of Gilmore County, Georgia, by a woman preacher leaving the Baptist church. Each year at this time, I shall be telling you of the Lord. Fog, gamecock, snake, and neighbor. Giving men all the help they need to drag their daughters into barns. Children, I shall be showing you the fox hide stretched out in the door like a flying squirrel. Fly open to show you the dark where the one pole of light is paid out in spring by the loft. And in it the croaker sacks sprawling and shuttling themselves into place as it comes through spiders dead, drunk on their threads. The hog's fat bristling, the milk snake in the rafters unbending through gnats to touch the last place alive on the sun with his tongue. I shall be flickering from my mouth oil, grease cans, lard cans, nubbins, cobs, night coming, floating, each May with night coming. I cannot help telling you how he hauls her to the center pole, how the tractor moves over as he sets his feet and hauls, ravels her arms and hair in stump chains, telling of Jehovah come and gone down on his belly, descending, creek curving, blowing his legs like candles out. It's a very dark poem, you know. I mean, what's going on in that scene is grotesque.
You really described this well in the piece in the magazine. You say that Dickey moves into the sermon form like the devil himself, flicking his forked tongue above the congregants, preaching at full throttle for 10 giant pages, his voice never breaking. So it's really remarkable stuff, and he really sustains that kind of length and intensity in a number of poems, so that, you know, whatever you would say about the bulk of his work, I mean, his greatest accomplishments, I still think have not, it's not a question of equaling them. Maybe that's not what poets do or want to do at this point, but I don't think there's anybody who writes about America in that vein, even though you would think they would, given our sort of cultural and other politics at the moment. I mean, he's describing a part of America that's a very, you know, important part of or ingredient of all these things that are happening around us now.
Right. I mean, you know what he reminds me of at times is the sustained bravado and strangeness and idiom of someone like Barry Hanna, although in a far less comic mode. And even although this is not Southern, there's a kind of resonance with Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, you know, which is sort of a cliche to invoke in a discussion of a sustained sort of diabolical register. But there's a kind of hierophantic intonation to Dickey's best work that reminds me in very different ways of both of those fiction writers.
Yeah, it makes me reflect on the possibility that American poets have sort of ceded that territory over to the fiction writers.
Yep.
And just like not really tried to go there anymore. It's sort of mysterious. Or maybe it's because we've inherited this feeling that Dickey had done that so well that you wouldn't do it anymore. But it is sort of mysterious.
Michael, you write that James Dickey and many other poets of his time shared, quote, a somewhat desperate and somewhat ridiculous refusal to accept that the cultural authority of the poet has been eclipsed.
One thing that I mean is that a largeness has vanished from poetic discourse and poetic authority that Dickey and James Wright sort of assumed as their birthright as poets. You know, they weren't afraid to be ridiculous in a way that I think we're afraid now. Dear God of the wildness of poetry is ridiculous. But it's also sort of madcap and self-serious in a way that testifies to the vitality of poetry that might have been diminished. And, you know, I'm very tentative about all of this because it's a mug's game to sort of try to speculate on the state of an art and its evolution when you're in the middle of it. But this is how it seems to me in an intuitive way.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
You can read Michael Robbins' review and everything else you heard on this program in the May 2014 issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.